Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. It's great to be back here after a little bit of a break. Yes, we were out of the country. My wife and I, Shannon, we went out to Japan for our first honeymoon in 19 years. We've been married 19 years now as of April, and we never had a chance to take a honeymoon, so we actually did it for the first time, and it was great to be able to do that. But now it's great to be back here on the air. Well, with three great authors we got today, 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio. We're going to kick it off with author J.E. Fishman, and then we're going to hit it to Nancy Allen, and then last is going to be Frank Nappy. So we got three great authors with three different great, unique perspectives in thriller writing and suspense writing today. So sit back, relax, enjoy, because 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. It's great to be back with everybody, and we want to thank you for listening however, whenever, and wherever you listen to the show. We're always here for you, and check out suspensemagazine.com for more information on everything else that goes on. So we're going to walk in right now here to our first guest. He is the author of the series called Bomb Squad New York City. You can go to bombsquadnyc.com for a lot more information. The newest book is called A Danger to Himself and Others. And we want to welcome author J.E. Fishman right now to the show. So, J.E., thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
So, again, so Bomb Squad NYC is the series. The book, A Danger to Himself and Others, is the one that we're talking about here right now at the beginning. So give us a little bit of background, not just of the series and the book, but kind of everything in general that went into this series and how it's going forward and kind of the goals of everything that you got going on with it.
Yeah, well, you know, what I was trying to do, first of all, I should tell you the genesis of the series, interestingly enough, I had never knew a cop in my life until a couple of years ago. Although, you know, I've always had, you know, something of a, you know, a fan's interest in reading about cops, big fan of Ed McBain and guys like that, you know, police procedurals. And it so happens I have my wife and I have a pied-à-terre in New York in the West Village, which is great, you know, hot, sexy neighborhood, in Manhattan. About two and a half blocks, up the street from our apartment, there are two garage doors in the back of a police precinct, and the garage doors say Bomb Squad on them. And so when we bought this apartment, you know, you walk around the neighborhood, and I noticed these garages, and I thought, this is interesting. You know, nobody's really paying much attention to these guys, and they must be, you know, must be fairly critical, especially, you know, in this day and age with terrorism and all this, you know, nonsense that goes on, and all the threats to New York. New York is a you know, been described as, you know, ground zero, not just because of 9/11, but because it continues to be, you know, a target. So one day we were walking home from dinner on a Saturday night, and lo and behold, these garage doors were open, and there were a bunch of cops sitting there smoking cigars, and the response vehicles were there, and they had one of them open, and they showed us the robot and they introduced us to one of the dogs, which are called explosive detection canines, EDCs, they call them. I started asking about it, and I discovered that there's only 3 dozen cops protect 8 million people from bombs in all of New York, and these guys were really interesting guys. It's the oldest, busiest, most sophisticated, technologically sophisticated bomb squad in the world. Hardly anybody's ever, give them any coverage. Now, part of that is because they're almost never in the news because they really keep a pretty low profile. So I started to wonder about, the possibilities, for doing something on the bomb squad. It occurred to me that, it's almost a cliche, the ticking time bomb. Hitchcock's got a famous, quote about building suspense, about having, the bomb under the table, and a couple of guys are talking about baseball, and, if you know that the bomb's under the table, it lends gravitas, to everything. The fact that this seemingly innocuous conversation suddenly, takes on this incredible importance, and you've got, in Hitchcock's example, the viewer's attention. In my example, the reader's, attention. And I thought, well, right on. So if you write about the bomb squad, well, there's always the potential for a bomb to go off, and maybe one's gone off, and you're wondering whether the next one's going to go off or. Whatever. So, it seemed to me to have great potential for thriller, material. But the problem I had was, there is sort of I wanted it to be technically accurate, and I didn't want to do, you could do research and find out, from the internet how to build a bomb, like those guys in Boston did. I didn't want to cross a line and be teaching people how to build bombs, but I wanted. Authenticity. I was fortunate that through a set of circumstances, a friend of mine who is an Army hero, literally a winner, a recipient, I should say, of the Congressional Medal of Honor, around the time I was, a real serious hero, in fact, was president of the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, this person, so he speaks a lot publicly. And it so happened I was at his house, and he said, "What are you working on?" And at the time I was finishing up The Dark Pool, which is my financial thriller. I said, "But I think the next thing I want to do is I want to do a series of books on the bomb squad." And he said, "Well, do you know anything about them?" And I sheepishly admitted, I said, "Well, I just started to do a little bit of research." He said, "I'll hook you up. I just spoke to the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators 2 weeks ago." So he introduced me to the number one bomb tech in the FBI, who introduced me to the current active commander of the NYPD bomb squad, a guy named Mark Torrey, Lieutenant Mark Torrey, who is also the longest serving member of the bomb squad in the NYPD. Very bright, engaged, guy, and he agreed to be my technical consultant on these books. And we've actually got. Just to correct you, John, we got 3 books, out. The Danger to Himself and Others is the first, but the first 3 are available now.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, when people go, like I said, go to Bomb Squad NYC, you find a lot more information because you got Death March, you got the long block hand. And I like the way you named them because you don't say book 1, 2, and 3. It's incident 1, incident 2, incident 3. So it kind of... lets people realize that, there's more stuff going on than just like, okay, here's, it's kind of a very unique way of putting it.
Yeah, I try to do it a little differently. I think, to say, incident makes it, it's got a little more energy, don't you think, than...
it does.
Than book or volume or whatever people say.
Right.
It's just, a little bit like, I did sort of a comic mystery called Cadaver Blues once that I wrote, and I called it a fiasco because, to sort of just communicate that it was so I always try to give a little extra twist.
But now let's get into, because when people go to the site, the one thing that you've also done is you built a nice database here, and you called it Bomb Squad's Finest. You list out, like, Lieutenant Joseph Capobianco, Sergeant Sandy Kahn. So you've now listed out these people. You put faces to their names. You've given them more identities than, you know, a lot of authors do.
Right.
So the thing is that, you know, when someone goes here, I mean, give us the idea of who these people are. I mean, I'm sure, I mean, this is not the real names, the real faces, you know, everything is made up. But you're giving them an identity by doing this. What was kind of behind, you know, when you decided to do this and give them this true identity, something that a lot of people do not do. I mean, they have their series characters, of course, but they don't really give them this kind of life and this kind of, I guess, exposure to the fact of, you know, hey, this is the whole Bomb Squad. They're real, making people, you know, making them real.
Right. You know, what I wanted to do, I mean, I was thinking, you know, back, you know, the genesis of Ed McBain, whom I consider, you know, I don't know how many people read him anymore, but he was sort of, you know, in his day, he was the number one police procedural writer, and he wrote about the NYPD, a fictional precinct. He'd gotten inspired by the television show Dragnet. To me, you know, when I set out to do this, I thought, well, you know, there are a lot of police procedural television shows, you know, out there. And that's a little bit of a frame of reference, you know, for people. And so rather than sort of, you know, just ignore that and just say, well, this is, quote unquote, you know, just a book series, I thought, well, what if I look at this as a dramatic series that happens to be having its first expression as a book series, it could have started life as a series of movies. It could have started life as a series of television shows. It just so happens that it's starting life, you know, as a series of books. And so I wanted to create, create this world, right? And the other thing is, because I'm tapping into the, you know, sort of emulating something that exists in real life, I sort of looked at the website and the world, you know, we're creating. I thought it would be fun to look at it as, it's almost like a Venn diagram. Venn diagrams, remember those, like, you know, when you've got two circles and one circle is
a set of
X, and the other is a set of Y, and where the circles overlap is where X and Y have in common, right? And so I sort of looked at it as, well, you've got the fictional world, and you've got the real NYPD. And so what do they have in common? The characters are different. I use a fictional precinct number and put it actually on a different street than where the real in the same neighborhood, but a different street than where the real Bomb Squad is. But what they have in common, they share a history. And in fact, I wrote a nonfiction history. I realized as I was doing my research that, you know, and this is not, these are not historicals, they're contemporary. But these guys are very in touch with their history. They're very proud of their history. They're one of the most elite squads, you know, in the NYPD. And the squad traces its beginnings to 1903. It was called the Italian Squad at the time. They were fighting a band of like mafia-like extortionists called the Black Hand, and that's how they started. And so they're very proud of their history. So the real life squad and the fictional squad share a history. They share technology. Okay, so like if I say they use X robot, if I say they use an F6A, they really do use the F6A in the NYPD. I would never give you a weapon or a mechanical device or any of that kind of stuff that they don't use
right.
in the actual NYPD bomb squad. And so they share that. And they share, you know, sort of techniques. They share a worldview, right? And this is where it's great to have Mark Torian advising me, because, you know, he'll say, well, we wouldn't think of this that way. We would think of it such and such way. Or, you know, well, we wouldn't, you know, that's not how we would do that, you know. And what's interesting
that brings
is
that realism it, in. So when people read the book,
right.
They get that sense of realism, you know, which is much different than, like, watching a CSI, which is totally different than what it really is in forensics. But you're giving the reader the sense of realism.
Right, and that's what we're trying to do. So I just thought it would be fun to have, you know, to really sort of bring it a little bit more to life on the website than your average, you know. Like my idea was not to have it look like your average, you know, author or your average book website, but, you know, look like a dramatic expression of this world.
So now, when you're looking at the three books, and I can you read them all? Should you read them all in order? Should you go 1, 2, 3? Is it possible to skip around? It just depends, you know, a lot of authors, it's just, you know, they have their own different ways of how they wrote it. How did you guys do it? How did you do it?
You don't have to read them in order. They're standalone. Standalone, I guess, is the wrong way to put it. They don't each. Somebody asked me the other day whether they each end in a cliffhanger, and they don't. They resolve, you know, the cases resolve at the end of each book, much like, I don't know, if you're reading a Jack Reacher series or something, you know,
right,
child,
right.
You know, each one does resolve. But the difference is between your standard sort of thriller series. That's you know, most of those are one character. They might have supporting characters, but it's always like the same detective or whatever. And what I've tried to do is more of an ensemble cast to sort of try to freshen this up a little bit, you know. And so you'll have characters who overlap. The central character in every book is Lieutenant Capobianco. Joe Capobianco is the commander of the squad. But even he is not always, I mean, he's not necessarily always the lead, you know, investigator or that kind of thing.
I was going to say, do you kind of change it up a little bit and say, hey, you know what, you know, I'm going to make this book, you know, more of a Sander Kahn book, or I'm going to put, you know, Manuel Diaz more in the forefront, or Kenneth Ridley more in the forefront. Do you kind of think of that when you're writing? That way it kind of exposes each person a little bit more to give them a little bit more character as the series goes on?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that interests me as a writer and as a person is, you know, when you think of, you know, I mean, we overuse in this country, you know, words like, you know, heroism and courage and, you know, bravery. I mean, you know, you're going to,
right,
you're going to hang up the phone today, John. You're going back to your wife, and she's going to say, "John, that was a heroic performance today." And, you know, but these guys are really, you know, these guys are really put themselves in harm's way at times. You know, I mean, to stand over a bomb. You know, even when they got that suit, by the way, it's 90 pounds of Kevlar. They don't wear gloves because they can't. They need their hands to if they get a deactivated device or whatever. But, you know, but they're all different people, right? They all have different backgrounds. They're different ethnicities. They come from different places. They go home to different, you know, personal, you know, issues.
It's kind of like a team sport. It's like with any team sport. I mean, a football player is a football player on the field, but he's not a football player when he goes home. And these guys are bomb squad people on the field, but they're not bomb squad guys when they go home. And that's the thing that you have to capture. That's your challenge.
That's right. Well, but also I think that, you know, the sort of the real heroism, you know, I have a problem with, you know, personally I find when I read a lot of series, I get bored after a few books. I'm like, well, I figured out who this guy is.
Oh, I'm with you. I am so with
you. But to me, real heroism is not, you know, sort of being the superhuman. It's the opposite. You know, it's being flawed and having personal problems and issues and all, you know, all the kind of stuff you're worrying about and having to set that aside to go do something dangerous for the common good. So each one of these is an opportunity. I look at each one of these as an opportunity to sort of bring these different characters, you know, to life and, you know, what their personal issues are. You know, the first book, Danger to Himself and Others, you know, Manny Diaz is a former Army EOD guy, Explosive Ordnance Division, the Hurt Locker type guys, and he's having trouble adjusting to you know, even though it's the busiest police bomb squad in the world, he's having trouble adjusting to the slower pace, and so he's starting to do crazy stuff. You know, he's walking on the edge of the highway, you know, trying to get an adrenaline rush, and yet he's got to go set that aside and, you know, and solve this case, you know, or not set it aside, right, and endanger everybody,
right?
And so, you know, I, but at the same time, I think what's going to happen, you know, over time, I think you will see these characters evolve. They certainly have a character arc in each book, but I think you will see them over time evolve. Even though you might see a character very briefly or sometimes maybe not even at all for one book, you may come back in another book and you'll notice that maybe they've changed a little bit. Maybe that drug problem they had is a little worse. Maybe their love life is, is a little different. Maybe the conflict that they had with a colleague is got inflamed or has calmed down. I really wanted to create a portrait over time of a whole squad. And these guys really are. They're so it's an incredibly elite squad, and they do certain things. In ways that no other unit of the NYPD does it. So just as a quick example of that is, in almost every other unit of the NYPD, in a situation in a case, you would always respect rank. In the NYPD bomb squad, whoever's closest to the bomb gets to decide. It does so you can have a guy who is a third-grade detective, if he's over the bomb, the sergeant, who's 100 feet behind him, cannot tell him what to do. That's the rules of the bomb squad, right? The guy closest to the danger gets to make the call, no matter, regardless of rank. And that's just a small example of how they're different. They're a very tight squad.
It's kind of very non-selfishness. It's just like non-selfishness. It's just like, look, we're not here for the glory. We're just here for the better good.
Yeah, there is a lot of it. They're very humble, guys in a way. They know, they're analytical. They unlike Manny Diaz, a little bit. Manny Diaz is by far the, well, actually, I take it back. I mean, I was going to say he's the craziest of all of them, but. The fourth book, which I'm working on now, that guy's having some issues too. That's Kieran Lane. He's the oldest guy in the squad, and he's obsessed with a case that supposedly was solved, but he doesn't believe it was solved. And that book that will be out in the fall is called Blast from the Past. But they do tend to be that, they have to really rely on one another, and they're rather analytical, and they don't want cowboys. And that's one of the concerns they have for this guy in the first book is this guy, Manny Diaz, being too much of a cowboy, and is he, endangering all of us, with his behavior? On the other hand, he has to think outside the box, in order to solve the case. And so these guys, it's sort of like, they have to impose order on a chaotic situation. That's what they do. And to some degree, every cop does that. But for these guys, it's almost more so. And there's always this danger, of another, another bomb's going to go off, and
right.
It may take somebody out. It may take them out.
So we got a couple, we got about 3 minutes or so left. So when you're so let everybody kind of know here. Okay. If they pick up the first book in the series and they start doing their thing, what's the one thing that you kind of want to kind of get across to the reader? What I mean, besides entertainment and the entertainment value and the thrill part of it, I mean, what's the one thing that you want the reader to kind of get away from when they put the book down?
Well, for me, I guess there's a couple of things. Number one is really that what real everyday heroes are, that they're flawed characters who have to, overcome their flaws in order to, protect the public. That's one thing. Another thing for me is these books are a little bit of a love affair with New York. I feel that too many people write about New York who don't know New York. And I'm constantly picking up books of all kinds, not necessarily just thrillers, where people, set stuff in New York. I mean, I read something, recently where somebody, had a regular cop, or was a regular detective, and he calls his captain. That doesn't happen in the NYPD. The captain is like five levels above you. That would be like some 26-year-old
right.
kid calling the CEO of IBM. It's like it doesn't
work. Yeah,
they're
watching a little too much Law and Order on that one.
Right, exactly. And so that, the neighborhoods. the, you know, the variety, you know, New York is a character in these books. And I look at New York as a character, you know, the physicality of it, the smells of it, the contrasts of New York. And one of the things that I personally just find so interesting is here you've got these guys, you know, essentially they're like blue collar plus, you know, guys. They make a decent living, but they're not wealthy, you know, people. And they're like they're in the hottest neighborhood in New York. Most of these guys couldn't afford, you know, to go out to dinner at half the restaurants in the West Village, where all the sort of swell people are hanging out. And yet, if there's a bomb under one of those tables, who's going to risk his life? You know.
Yeah.
Hopefully you take away the real grit of New York, and the real. Gravitas behind what these guys, you know, do, that they live, you know, with real danger, and yet they're real, on some level, they're regular people, you know, I mean, they're not regular people in that most of us would never volunteer to do this, but on another level, you know, the difference between your average Joe and a real-life superhero is only a few steps, but they're crucial steps, you know, and so it's not that everybody can do it, but that's what interests me, is that real human beings, you know, engaging in activities that are truly dangerous, you know, that are real heroism, you know, and that said, of course, because these are thrillers, you know, if you compare it to real life, this is the 1% of the cases, it's not the 99% of the cases, right?
Right.
But that's what, you know, that's what's worth writing about.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jay, we want to thank you so much for coming on and you know, talking about the book. The other website people can go to is jefishman.com. But to see everything that's going on about Bomb Squad NYC, you go to bombsquadnyc.com to see the books in the series. Again, three books are out, A Danger to Himself and Others, Death March, and A Long Black Hand. Those are all the books out right now. So we want to thank you again for coming on and talking to us. And, you know, hey, we talk to you in the future.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, John.
All right. You have a good one.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right. So, again, everybody, that is author J.E. Fishman, and the books are called Bomb Squad NYC. Check them out. See what's going on. As you could hear from J.E., you got a lot of realism coming on within these books, a lot of things that he likes to, you know, make – known to you, like you said, making New York more of a character than just a city in itself. The other thing that we got to do here is we got to pay a little bit of bills, so we got to start telling you what's coming up here in the future. And in July, it's always a big thing, and we want you to realize that what's coming on in July is Thriller Fest. So take a listen.
It's time for a face-off, where mystery meets suspense. Join us at the 9th Annual Thriller Fest. Learn from top industry leaders and authors at Craft Fest. Get your story heard by industry professionals at Pitch Fest. Celebrate the new 2014 Thriller Master Scott Turow, along with 2013 Thriller Master Anne Rice, Silver Bullet winner Brenda Novak, and a list of special guests you'll have to see to believe. July 8th through the 12th at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, the premier conference for thriller enthusiasts, those who read them and those who write them. And find out about the new ITW anthology Face-Off, where the world's greatest thriller characters meet head-to-head in 11 electrifying stories. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
Also, what we have here is a book called Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews, which is available now from Pocket Books. In the grand spy tale tradition of John le Carré, comes Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews, a shocking thriller written with insider detail known only to a veteran CIA officer. In present-day Russia, ruled by blue-eyed, unblinking President Vladimir Putin, Russian intelligence officer Dmytro Egrova struggles to survive in the post-Soviet intelligence jungle. Ordered against her will to become a sparrow, a trained seductress, Dominika is assigned to operate against Nathaniel Nash, a young CIA officer who handles the agency's most important Russian moles. As the action continues between Russia and Finland, Greece, Italy, the United States. D'Amica and Nate soon collide in a duel of will, tradecraft, and inevitability, forbidden passion that threatens not just their lives, but those of others as well. Secret alliances are made and broken. D'Amica and Nate's game reaches a deadly crossroads. Soon one of them begins a dangerous double existence and a life-and-death operation that consumes intelligence agencies from Moscow to Washington, D.C. Pick up Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews now in paperback from Pocket Books. We're going to take just a short break and be back with our next guest, Nancy Allen, who is going to talk to us about her latest book, The Color of the Hills. So hold on and enjoy, and we'll see you in just about 2 minutes. So welcome back, everybody. We want to thank you again for listening to Suspense Radio, however, whenever, and wherever you're listening to us. We enjoy and love bringing you the show here every other Saturday. Glad to be back after a little bit of a vacation. And we're going to jump right here and now into our next author. Her name is Nancy Allen. She is the author of the book, The Code of the Hills and Ozark's Mystery. It's book one in the series. So, Nancy, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great and so excited to be talking with you today, John.
Well, we want to thank you for coming on. It's always great to be able to see new authors with new books, great ideas, great concepts, great writing. And so we're excited to have you on. And so tell us about The Code of the Hills, a little bit inside information. I love the cover of it.
Isn't it beautiful?
Just screams ghost. It just screams ghost stories, just screams mystery.
Well, you know what I love about the cover is that contrast of that beautiful Ozark sunset with that dark house on the dark hill with the stark trees. And I do think that that does convey something about this book. You know it is set in the Ozark Hills because I am a genuine hillbilly. I'm the real article. I've lived in the Missouri Ozarks all my life. And like that cover, my book celebrates the Ozarks in a lot of ways. It's beautiful, magnificent, untouched country, but we do have long-time traditions here that are kind of based on this hillbilly tradition, and some of those traditions are have a darker side and show not only the beautiful side of the Ozarks, but also some of the dark sides of the Ozarks as well. You know, it's a legal thriller. It's a legal thriller, a courtroom
right.
drama, like what John Grisham would write, although, one reviewer said that you should think John Grisham meets Dan Waddrell. Dan Waddrell is the author of Winter's Bone. So it is a courtroom drama, but set in our Missouri Ozark Hills. One difference from both Waddrell and Grisham, though, is that my protagonist, my main character, is female. She's a young single woman assistant prosecutor in the Ozarks, and she has been assigned a terrible sex case. An incest case, and we've got a fair amount of incest in the Ozarks. My county in the state has the highest rate of child sex crimes in the state of Missouri. So that is something that is, as I said, the dark side of this beautiful area where we live.
Yeah, I mean, that gives a whole new meaning to the show me state. So we're looking here, you know, Elise Arnold, main character prosecutor.
Yeah, that's Elsie. You're
know.
Giving her a French twist to her name because you're from the city. But Elsie's
I
from the country.
I am the worst in names. Everybody knows
that's
I'm
all
the
right.
worst in names.
That's
I'll
all right.
Your
but
name.
Just say Elsie.
Yeah.
Elsie Arnold.
Elsie.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Elsie Arnold, when you were deciding, hey, you know what, I need a main character to drive my books, why was she the one you picked?
Okay, you know, Elsie is, she's an Ozarks girl, and she's a prosecutor. And when I crafted her, I read a lot of suspense fiction, and I love female protagonists. But the thing that bothers me about the women who are main characters in thrillers is it's like they always make them be like Superwoman. They never make mistakes. The medical examiner or the detective, they're always right, and they don't make mistakes. And when it's time to eat, they just pick at a plate of salad. And when they're stressed out, they put on running shoes and run for 10 miles. And you know what? I think that's a bore, and I can't relate. So when I made my main character, Elsie Arnold, I thought this girl is going to be flawed. I want her to have feet of clay. So Elsie's heart is in the right place, but she makes mistakes. She messes up in her personal life, and sometimes she makes legal mistakes in her practice. And in addition, when it's time to eat, Elsie drives through the drive-thru at McDonald's, or she pulls into the Sonic drive-in and orders up a foot-long Coney dog. And when she is stressed out and needs stress relief, she runs to the nearest bar and slams beer like a frat boy, because I think that's fun to read about.
That is a big push right now that's going on in writing. Like we just talked to the last author who was on the show, and bringing the realism back into characters is definitely something that was lost for a little bit of a time. I mean, I always used to pick up thriller books, and how many times could I read, this is the most diabolical killer this guy's going to ever face? Okay, but you said
exactly.
that in the last book.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Exactly.
So I get where you're coming from.
You know, and in the hero area, though, because I think this is interesting, because we do get to see male anti-heroes, right? The conflicted
right.
male anti-hero. And I don't know if you're a fan of the HBO series. I certainly am. But like on True Detective, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, they get to be these guys. They're the heroes. Their heart's in the right place. They want to do the right thing, but they are so flawed and conflicted. And that's interesting to see. And so we get to see the male anti-hero. We get to, even Jack Reacher walks around, doesn't have a bar of soap, just a toothbrush. You know, we get to see these male heroes who have all these quirks and all these flaws. But the women are always such goody good girls. It's like, let's have some equal time for some flaws in the female hero. How about that? So I thought, I am bringing it. I am bringing the realistic, flawed female heroine to suspense fiction, and that is one thing that I hope I have accomplished in The Code of the Hills. Oh, she cuts like a sailor. Did I say that?
That's all right. Now, you didn't read the magazine where we actually interviewed, I think it's Nick Spallanzi, the creator and writer of True Detective.
Oh, my God, I've got to read that because, you know, I am absolutely nuts about True Detective. I just chew on my knuckle waiting for the next season to begin because it kind of was my reason to live there for a while.
Yeah, we got lucky. HBO contacted us. And then we interviewed the writer, creator of the show. He gave us the whole inside information. It was really interesting. So I'm going to have to now email that to you so you can read it.
I just can't believe you didn't know about that. I would.
But now,
because that is one cool show, and those characters are fascinating, and the whole Southern Gothic thing. And I love Southern Gothic, but you know, my book is, I think we would have to call it Hillbilly Gothic, Ozarks Gothic, and this hillbilly noir thing, we're kind of Southern, but we're really our own unique world here in the Ozarks. We still retain this unique culture of the Ozark Hills, which, like I said, it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, the setting that I have in this book is true to life. It's these unspoiled hills and waterways, and we still have the folk culture, folk music. They're still making moonshine here, honest to God. But on the other side, people in the Ozarks are and have always been hostile to outsiders and suspicious of government interference and very resistant to change. And what the Code of the Hills, which you know is the title, the Code of the Hills is an old saying around here that had different layers of meaning. It essentially meant, though, that a man was entitled to do whatever he wanted to with his property and with his family, and no one was to interfere. And so outsiders, we would always circle the wagon against outsiders. And in the family circle, it was also a guarded circle. But like I said, when you have generational patterns of incest, this code of the hills creates a code of silence. And they are never to speak of this guarded family secret of incest. It was never to be spoken of to outsiders. I didn't tell you I was a prosecutor. Well, we'll get to that. But I was a prosecutor, came back to the old hometown of Springfield, Missouri, after I got out of law school, and I handled these sex cases. And I had to bust through that wall of silence, this code of the hills, in order to successfully prosecute sex cases. And I will tell you, it is tough. And that is one of the challenges that my main character faces.
Yeah, and I think that that's good when you bring that sense of realism that you had to go through into your character and now into your book. But the one thing that, of course, when you come out, and like we said, this is the first of the series, and again, I want to tell everybody that we're speaking here with author Nancy Allen. Go to nancyallenauthor.com for more information on the book, The Code of the Hills, The Ozarks Mystery, so book one. But when you have to do the villains, you, of course, since you prosecuted, you probably have a lot of things to go off of. You have a lot of people that you prosecuted and a lot of different things that you kind of brought in. So when you sat down to think about how, you know, who did I want Elsie to go up against, did you kind of bring, again, in that sense of this is what I need to, from the villains and things that you prosecuted, you kind of brought different pieces together to make the one that she's going up against.
You know, and you have it exactly right, because I was in the prosecutor's office for years, and so I had a body of trial experience. And people say, well, which case did you pick to base this on? Ah, no, this is a fictional story. But because I had this body of trial experience, I was able to draw on elements that I saw in these cases and in things that happen in jury trials. And particularly, you know, this first book has to do with a sex case, and there are elements that you see over and over again. Now, you said my villain is a villain, But part of the Ozarks mystery is the other people in the book, to what extent are they more or less responsible? To what extent have they permitted this to continue? Or it is sometimes it takes a while for the main character and for the reader as well. They're going to have to figure out who's wearing the white hat and who's wearing the black hat and who is shades of gray, and because there, as it turns out, there is not just one bad guy in the novel. There are a number of people who have varying issues and layers of guilt in this. But
and,
in these sex cases, I beg your pardon, it's never just one person that causes something to be able to happen. There are circles of people that permit these patterns of crimes to continue unchecked in our community. And so that's kind of something that I evaluate and investigate in this book.
And so when you decided that this is what you were going to do and you were going to get into, why did you all of a sudden pick, hey, you know what, I'm going to write this as a mystery series? What point did you decide to say, I want to keep exploring Elsie further instead of just making one standalone book after one standalone book?
You know, I fell in love with my protagonist. I could story tell about this girl till the cows come home because,
And that doesn't happen in California, so that must be another Ozark thing.
Oh, my goodness.
When the cows come home.
Yeah, I guess that's that. One of my regional expressions. If you like that one, you'll get to read a million of them.
But I was born and raised in the Midwest, so I know exactly where you're coming from.
Okay, very glad to hear.
Yeah.
But anyway, I like my character. And when you read the book, you will know she has not reached the end of her road, either professionally or in her personal life. There's lots more that we can explore with Elsie, and Elsie's got a lot more of a job to do. So I think Elsie needs to continue that journey, and I think that the reader is going to enjoy walking that road along with her.
And when the book came out, I mean, how much kind of apprehension, or how were you nervous at all to kind of get your first reviews, to kind of see how it would be out in the public, how people would accept it? How was that feeling?
You know what? I have been overwhelmed with so much positive reception, and it's a little bit like you pop out a full-grown baby and you wonder whether people are going to say your baby's ugly or not. So anyway, it is the scariest thing on earth, and any author who says it doesn't, it isn't scary is a liar. That's what I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it came out, and I have been so fortunate to receive so much overwhelming positive response. But there are some funny things, and since I'm talking to my friend out in California, I will mention, you know, for one thing, it's in libraries, because libraries have e-books, and I went online, and I was amazed. I mean, I was knocked over to see it's in the New York City Public Library. It's in Ontario, Canada, California, New Orleans, Louisiana. Guess what? It is not in any library in the state of Missouri. It's just crazy. And similarly, it's been reviewed in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm in the Library Journal. It's going to be the book review in the Kansas City Star in a week from tomorrow. And in the Ozarks, our big cities are St. Louis and Kansas City. They'll talk about the book. Guess who won't? My little local newspaper, the Springfield News Leader. Not interested. Maybe it casts too much of a light. Maybe I'm shining too much of a light or looking with too much of a magnifying glass. Or maybe it's what Jesus used to say about a prophet in his own hometown. Whatever it is, I'm getting all kinds of fabulous response, but from the institutions in the Ozarks.
But now that the book is coming out, and now you're getting a lot of great response, reviewers love it, readers are loving it, how much pressure is that going to put on you for book two, though?
You know what? I got a day job. I'm on the faculty of Missouri State University, so I teach all day and I meet with students. And then in the meantime, there has been editing on this book, and now there's promotion on this book. And what is slipping away is that on the 1st of July, by contract, I am to turn in the manuscript of the sequel.
Uh-huh.
Guess what? It's not ready. So my semester does end in 2 weeks, and I am going to have to work like a house of fire to get that baby done. But I'll do it. I'll do it. I just haven't quite gotten to it yet. But I got it in my head, you know. And that is that's more than half the job.
And how was that journey when you finally realized that you wrote the end, that you're actually in the beginning of the book, just to try to get it sold, get it out? Whether you, did you go the agent route? Did you go the straight publisher route? How did you kind of
work
it
yourself? Oh, Lord, that's a tale, too. Now, I first started writing The Code of the Hills about 5 years ago. And the first draft of the manuscript, it took 6 months. 6 months from writing chapter one to writing the end. And so I thought, whoa, I'm done, which, you know, I was not. But at that point, I'd figured out enough to know that the way to go, I thought, was to have literary representation. So I set about, trying to get an agent, and I got one. Took 10 months. And then she and I, we fiddled around with it for a year, and really we weren't making much progress. The day that she emailed me and said, you know, the language that your protagonist uses is really off-putting, all the cuss words. I want you to remove those. And I thought, I don't believe you understand the character I have created, so I quit, or I fired her, or whatever you say when you part ways with an agent. But then it just took 2 weeks, and I got another one, and she and I hung together for a year, and we made great progress, but that's a whole nother story. At some point, she and I parted ways, and then within 48 hours, the seas parted, and I was united with Jill Maher of the Sandra Dykstra Literary Agency. Hello, sunny California. And Jill Maher and I worked on it from an editorial point of view, and then Jill took that baby out, and she sold it to HarperCollins. So happy ending, but it's not something that happens in a day or an hour. It took a long time.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, it always is one of those journeys that a lot of authors, once they feel they write the end, they're actually done, and it's like, no. You got a long way to go. I always like to hear the journeys, you know, the journeys that new authors have had to go and do, because it does help other authors that are kind of in the position that you were at the beginning. And so, you know, you just have to always tell them, you just gotta keep faith.
And sometimes, like, for example, in the beginning, I think I had, because at the time the Twilight books were so big, and Stephanie Meyer had a blog, and she said, here is my journey. I had a dream. I wrote a book. And then I sent out 16 query letters to agents, and one of them fell in love with it, and a month later it was sold. And I thought, so that's how it works. No, that is not the general story. That was one of those miracle flukes, I think, for Stephanie Myers. And good for her, but it doesn't work that way for anyone else in the world. So it is not a short journey. It's a long journey. You know what else? When you're a writer from Springfield, Missouri, in the middle of nowhere with no publishing contacts and no publishing background in history, there is an iron wall in New York City, and you got to get your foot in that door somehow, and it takes some doing. But one thing I did learn is you have to be immune to discouragement, because if you're easily discouraged, they'll slap you down, and then you're done. What you've got to do, and you slap down and told no and rejected, and you dust yourself up and get off the floor and go at it again. That is my advice.
Yeah, that's the important thing. And now it's funny because, you know, you are feeling the pressure of exactly, deadline now, and I didn't used to have that before.
That's true.
Well, what am I going to do?
Because it used to be, do I feel like writing today? Do I want to write today? No, it's going to be a got-to job. But that's what I wanted, you know. That's a privilege, so.
So now we got a couple minutes left here, so looking into the future, what are fans going to be able to expect from book two and from seeing you into the future about what you got going on?
What I think fans will be looking for is, what is the next case? And there's always going to be another case, because one thing about the prosecutor's office, there is a steady flow of business. So Elsie's going to have another case. But like all cases in prosecution, the ones that go to trial are not the easy ones where a guy confesses to a video camera. She's going to have another problem case. But she will have to. It'll have to be something she believes in, because Elsie is not about prosecuting the innocent, because that's not how she rolls. So she is going to have another problem case, and as always, it will have certain problems and parallels with the with her mess-ups in her personal life, because Elsie stumbles. She stumbles, and she falls, but then she picks herself up, and she'll go along. So we shall meet new characters, and then you will also revisit familiar characters, and let's just see what Elsie does next.
Well, I'll tell you what, Nancy, we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your journey and, of course, your book here that is just out now, The Code of the Hills, An Ozarks Mystery. Great to have you on. Very entertaining, very funny. Love the passion that you have with your work and the book and the characters, and wish you nothing but success. And would love to have you on when the next one comes out, so keep us in mind.
I would love to come back, John. And thanks so much. This has been a ton of fun.
Well, thank you, and enjoy. And, hey, keep us up to date on what's everything that's got going on.
You betcha. I sure will. And you have a beautiful Saturday.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Nancy Allen. Go to nancyallenauthor.com to find out a lot more information, be able to connect with her on Facebook, Twitter, see the book, The Code of the Hills, An Ozark Mystery, get a little bit more inside information to who she is. We find it very fascinating. Debut book, debut author, go get it. We are going to be back here with our last guest of the day. His name is Frank Nappy. The book is Nobody Has to Know. Author Nelson DeMille loved it. So what more do you have to know than that? I mean, number one New York Times bestselling author Nelson DeMille gives it two thumbs up. So we're going to be right back with Frank. And in the meantime, you're going to sit back and enjoy this.
welcome back, everybody, here to our last segment of the show. We want to thank J.E. Fishman and Nancy Allen for being on earlier to talk about their books. But now we're going to come into the last guest we have here of the show. He's author Frank Nappe. You can go to franknappe.com. That's N-A-P-P-I.com. He is diving into the thriller realm with a book called Nobody Has to Know. So if you're friends of Frank and you know his other work, this is something much different. And so, Frank, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Hello from New York, and thanks, John, for having me. I'm great.
So, New York, L.A., here we go. We're on two different coasts. So why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of background information like we always like to know about authors and your kind of reasoning, maybe why you're jumping into the thriller scene with your latest book here, Nobody Has to Know.
Yeah, well, as you said, this is a departure for me from my usual work. So before I tell you about Nobody Has to Know, it's probably important for me to provide some of that background as to how it came to be. I've had success as an author with what I guess most people would classify as more traditional genres, not as exciting as thrillers. In 2005, St. Martin's Press published my Echoes from the Infantry, which is a World War II historical fiction piece that explores the residue of war that we have all come to know now as post-traumatic stress disorder. It did really well with the readers who live with fathers who were distant and unavailable due to the echoes of combat, and was equally popular with readers who enjoy family drama. There's a lot that goes on there with the family members who are struggling to understand this guy who is an enigma to them because of all the experiences that he had. I followed that one up with my Mickey Tusser books, which chronicle the improbable rise to baseball prominence by 17-year-old autistic pitcher during the late 1940s. And these books were successful as well on the same dramatic level as readers found the struggle to overcome, I guess you could call insurmountable odds, heartwarming and on one level inspirational as well. And a lot of folks identify with the autism piece and, of course, the baseball components, which are popular with so many people. And in fact, the original story was adapted in 2011 for a TV movie called A Mile in His Shoes, starring Dean Cain, which was really obviously a thrill for me. It was not what I expected at all to happen when the book came out, so I was pleased with that. So I've had a very productive 10 years as what most folks would classify as traditional author. Now let's get to the good stuff. So not long after the second Mickey Tusser novel was published by Skyhorse Publishing, my agent at the time suggested I attempt to do something a little more commercial, something a little more gritty and heart-pumping. And I loved the idea, but was more than a little incredulous as to whether or not I could pull it off. The mystery thriller genre, in my opinion, now is truly the king of all fiction, because people love that kind of stuff. So to say that I was a little more than intimidated was probably an understatement. But, you know, I'm always up for a challenge, so I began playing with the ideas. And actually, there was an idea I had been harboring only in the deepest recesses of my imagination because of the subject matter. As many people who know me or follow my work know, I'm a high school English teacher. So the story was a story of a young high school English teacher, a guy who's engaged and appears to have it all, except for the fact that he's never really come to terms with the tragic loss of his first love. And this leads him to make a very poor decision, becoming romantically involved with one of his female students. So being that I am a high school English teacher myself, the idea raised more than a few eyebrows, and I had to keep reminding people that it's important to separate the artist from the art. So that was very controversial when it first came out, the idea when it came out, but I think some of the controversy sort of spawned a lot more interest as well. So my protagonist makes this poor choice. He succumbs to his desire for this very needy, very beautiful student of his. They see each other a few times outside of school, and he remains conflicted over it. And just when he has a sudden epiphany or moral awakening, if you want to call it that, and realizes that he probably shouldn't go too much further, something happens, and there's no spoiler alert here. I don't want to say it because it will ruin one of the major twists in the plot. But something happens that catapults him into a downward spiral that includes a series of text messages from an unknown party blackmailing him and leading him through a pretty hair-raising sequence of events, including a shocking ending that many readers have found to be the best part of the book. So the idea No One Has to Know is a psychological thriller. I chose to publish independently after so many publishing houses, despite their praise for the fast-paced action and writing style, they balked at the protagonist and his decision to get involved with a 17-year-old student of his. Now, I suppose if he were a vampire or a zombie, it would be more palatable to readers. But they said, oh, Frank, you can't do that with the regular protagonist. No one's going to like that. Their contention, I suppose, was that readers would find him off-putting and would not read the story. I really disagreed. I felt in my heart, you know, when you write, you know something is true and doable, and I just had a feeling that this was. And I'm happy to say that dozens of readers not only tolerated the protagonist, they actually found him compelling. And the reviews for the book have been really more than I could ever have wanted. And one of these readers included best-selling author Nelson DeMille, who blurbed the book with such effusive praise that I knew I had created something worthy of the genre. So, you know, what started as something that I thought I was not going to be able to do turned out to be this wonderfully new experience and has sort of excited, you know, a part of me that I didn't think I even had. So that's sort of where it came from.
Yeah, and, you know, the one thing that you're going with, there's a couple things, because now you're hearing in the news a lot about teachers with students. I hear more of that than I ever did. I mean, I didn't know where the hell those teachers were when I was going to school. But now you're hearing a lot of more teachers with students. And now, of course, the text messaging with the bullying and the stalking, whatever. So you brought a couple things that are coming out a lot more today, and you're kind of researching all that. So being like, you know, a high school teacher that, you know, that you are, how much of that do you see, you know, the realism every day about what's going on, whether it's the bullying and the stalking on Facebook, text messages, Instagram, whatever these kids now have to use in order to kind of get themselves, you know, to be more of an ass, I guess.
Well,
that's just me.
The social media has definitely broken down some of the traditional boundaries that, you know, have existed for years between, you know, teachers and students. And, you know, sometimes, it's a situation where it's helpful in that, you know, it can enhance communication with regard to curriculum and assignments and allowing students who perhaps are a little disaffected to feel a little more connected in the classroom and a little more motivated. But when you start playing with personalities, and some of those personalities may be fractured or they may have a past that involves unresolved issues, emotional, psychological, whatever the case may be, it sort of, you know, becomes a situation where you might have trouble. And in the book, Nobody Has to Know, you have characters who are not despicable by any stretch of the imagination, but they're flawed. And, you know, their psyches are somewhat damaged. And the confluence of those personalities creates a situation, and of course the text messaging allows it to happen, in some instances, where these characters, especially the protagonist, are thrown into situations now that they can no longer handle. And it's that sort of escalation of conflict and the feeling of helplessness and how do I get out of what I started that sort of becomes like the thrust behind the story.
So why Cameron? Why is he the perfect one to be you know, the lead in your first thriller book?
Well, he possesses a lot of the personality traits that sort of allow him to get sucked into this particular situation. He's, when people read the book, they'll know him from his background as being a person who suffers a little bit from this Superman complex, where he's gotten involved in the past with people, females in particular, who are in need of saving in some way. They're damaged themselves, or they're dealing with situations at home that are difficult, and he feels as though he could be the one to remedy some of those things. In addition, as I said before, he has something in his own past that he's yet to reconcile with. So the combination of those two things renders him really susceptible to this one young girl who, you know, is a little maybe too aggressive, too forward. She's needy. She sees something in him that she likes, and he is ill-equipped to fend her off in a timely fashion. It's, by the time he realizes he shouldn't be doing it, he's in it already, and it's too late.
Yeah, you know, and what it reminds you a little of, because did you ever see that movie The Crush with Alicia Silverstone? I mean, that scared the hell out of me. I mean, it was like, I mean, to see someone getting that, I guess, just so involved. I mean, just, and they've had these, you know, stories before. It just enthralls me to see that kind of human psyche get that immersed into somebody or just that crazy over somebody. I'll tell you, I just don't get that. I just don't get it. And so to
it's got
to be a little bit of a challenge.
Oh, a lot of readers have said the appeal, and I think this is the appeal of the genre as well. You know, so many times you think in your life of the crossroads that you're at, and you know, you almost made a decision, and then fortunately maybe you didn't do that, and you say to yourself, "Gosh, I wonder what would have happened if I had done that. Thank God I didn't." And these thrills at their very core are escapist and entertaining on so many levels, and in many instances, they're also alarmingly cathartic, as in the case of Nobody Has to Know. Again, so many of us have been faced with these potentially dangerous situations and opportunities and didn't do the wrong thing. But now as they're reading, consider silently, what happens if I had done that? You know, but the nice thing about reading is, you know, these stories are thrilling and mesmerizing, and if done right, completely addicting. You know, they're stories about danger, about taking readers out of their comfort zone, all from the safety of their everyday life. They can read about this and know, oh, gee, thank God it's not me. And because these characters are under great duress and are placed in anxiety-filled circumstances, I think as readers we become more intimately acquainted with them a lot faster because each scene is so emotionally charged. And psychological thrillers are all the more riveting simply because all of us at some point struggle with those internal demons. And sometimes we even harbor secrets that threaten to destroy our well-being. And then, of course, if someone finds out about it, that's when, you know, really the problem. So this guy, this regular guy, Cameron, makes a bad decision, and he thinks he's covered it up. But to his horror, he learns that somebody out there knows about it. And now this individual wants something from him. It's an interesting concept in that from the psychological aspect of things, sort of renders him completely vulnerable. You know, there's no escape from that tension and anxiety. It's not like, I guess, the traditional thriller, maybe where the villain is after the main character trying to kill him or do something like that. In that instance, it's perhaps protection that can be provided from other people or from daylight or crowds or whatever. But the intensity in a psychological thriller is a silent sort of killer. It's ever-present, and, you know, there's the struggle. How do I deal with it? How do I get away from what I'm trying to escape from? So that's, I think, a lot of what appeals to people when they read the book.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But psychological thrillers are actually probably, they're one of my favorites to read just because it does explore a lot more character development, a lot more what the characters kind of have to do than just running around and trying to dodge a killer or catch a killer. It's a lot more involved, especially with the author having to write. I mean, having to put that kind of a story together, you do have to kind of put yourself maybe in a little of a dark place in order to kind of understand where your characters are come from. And that definitely took you out of a comfort zone because that's something you've never done before. So how is that having to do that with you, putting yourself kind of in those old positions and then having to wake up and go to school the next day and living it?
Right. Well, you know, the nice thing about it, I always remember I took a creative writing class my freshman year of college, and, you know, the one thing that the professor, it wasn't a particularly good class, but the one thing the professor had said to me that I remember still is, you know, to write about things that you know about, you know. Now, again, I got to be careful, not to say that I've had this experience, but being in high school.
I was just going to say, what do you know, Frank? What do you know?
You know what, I suppose marketing-wise, if I was smart marketing-wise, I probably would let that out there and maybe have people speculate what they think.
But go ahead.
Being in a high school for over 25 years, you know, you see the way things work. You see the dynamics between, you know, colleagues and the way between some adults and some of the young people there. And you know that it's fraught at times with all sorts of potential disaster, as I said before, if the right personalities, or in some cases I guess you could look at it as the wrong personalities, get twisted together. So the venue was natural for me. And, of course, there are scenes in the book that take place in school that are very authentic because, as you said, it's what I live every day. As far as getting in the head of the character, I loved it. Out of the comfort zone in this case was a great thing because it was challenging and it was, you know, a way for me to see if I could craft something different from what I've usually done. But the biggest difference I found, the biggest difference in crafting a thriller as opposed to the more artistic, dramatic work that I've done is probably the pacing of the plot. There's not a lot of time or the same amount of time to, you know, do things like to dabble in flashback, to provide a lot of character development. I think in the thrillers, if you lose the tempo and the pace, you lose your reader. This was my main concern as I embarked on this new quest. You know, I still did significant character development, so the readers would know this is not really, you know, a twisted, you know, damaged individual. He's just, you know, someone who has not come to terms with some of the emotional things in his own life, and he makes a bad choice. And the bad choice, of course, as we said before, sort of escalates into something that he never could have imagined. But when Nelson DeMille used words like briskly paced page turner, I was delirious because I knew that my biggest fear, which was the pacing, I tackled that okay, and I did not get mired in some of the other stuff that could bog down, you know, a thriller.
Yeah. I'll tell you, 25 years in high school, dude, I couldn't wait. I could not wait to get out after four. I don't know how you went back for 25 of those years. That's enough just to make you nutty. But
it does.
Were thrillers the books that you grew up writing? I mean, reading. I mean, was that the authors you fell in love with? So you kind of still had a basis to kind of know, you know, what you wanted to do when you sat down to write the book.
You know, it's funny because I didn't do a lot of reading when I was younger. Obviously, in college, I did more and then recreationally afterwards as well. So I never really I didn't imagine myself ever writing a novel to begin with. I always loved to write, but it seemed so daunting to me, the prospect of sitting down and putting something together that's 200 or 300 pages long. It just didn't seem, you know, possible. And my foray into the novel writing really came, you know, as I said, with Echoes from the Infantry, which was about these two World War II veterans that I became very close with through school. And that was a very emotional work for me because it was tied to the friendship I had with these two men, and a lot of what I tackling there were their stories and their struggles. So I felt it was profound, and I wanted to write it because there was purpose. I guess the same thing happened with the Mickey Tussa books, too. I love baseball, and I do a lot of work with Challenger Baseball, which is special needs baseball, and Best Buddies, and organizations like Autism Speaks. You know, my family's involved with that. And so there's a link there, too, and I think that people need to know certain things about special needs individuals, and so that was important, too. The suggestion by my agent at the time, who said, you know, you got to do something really kind of commercial and maybe try that because people like to read about stuff like that. And I almost felt, and again, I love the genre, don't get me wrong, but I almost felt like I was selling out a little bit or cheapening my work by pandering to what people want to read. So that was my reservation at first. Although I love the genre, as I said, I love watching the films, and there are some books that I've read that have been fabulous that have been, you know, thrillers. I just did not want to write something that was gratuitous in any way. Like just to write a thriller just for the sake of writing a thriller, I wanted there to be some kind of substance there to it. And
right, I guess when so.
When people read the book, they realize that it's more than just, you know, more than a manipulation and an attempt to, like, get readers, like, uncomfortable and what's going to happen next, which is all good. But at the end, I think that they realize there's something, you know, more important to be said there as well as just being entertained. So I was trying to, you know, I guess, create like an amalgamation between like the traditional novel and the thriller and provide something for everybody. And, you know, so far it's worked out okay. The feedback's been great.
Yeah, and now when the book was coming out, and you kind of talked about a little bit of those, you know, those reservations, but now you got to feel extremely excited about how people are reacting to it, you know, how your work is being, you know, viewed and received by fans that, you know, because now you got a whole new world that you've just opened up to yourself.
Yes, very excited, very I'm surprised on one level, and laughing a little bit to myself, as now some publishers have come around and, you know, made contact and wanted to know about Nobody Has to Know, and perhaps doing, you know, a reissue of the book, because now they've seen that, you know, oh, some readers, you know, really didn't have reservations about the character, and it wasn't a deal breaker for them, and they understand, you know, the value of the story. And, you know, so many of the readers who have responded favorably to Nobody Has to Know have asked me about, you know, are you doing another thriller? And I just actually completed another one that I'm...
you like it now. You caught the bug.
Right.
Exactly. Now you caught the bug.
I said, I got to do this at least one more time. And,
It's like getting your first tattoo. The second one's easier than the first one. And the third tattoo's even easier than that.
I guess. So my agent right now is shopping that one around. And I've had actually, you know, like I said, publishers inquire about the new one and also perhaps the old one as well. And there's been some talk about, well, you know, this will be a great, like, you know, movie type of story. You know, so there's a lot going on with it, which I guess is exclusive to this sort of genre. I mean, people, you know, are excited, whereas I got a lot of emails from people on the other books that were like, oh, thank you, like, this is touching, and you've, like, you know, you've moved me, and it's, and I've now reconciled with, you know, a family member, thanks to the book, which is all very rewarding, and it's great that you can affect someone's life through writing. But the emails I'm getting about this book is, man, this was really exciting, it was fun, I loved it, where's the next one? So that's good.
So what is that? So I just found, so you self-published this one?
Yes.
When you talk about publishers, I thought you already had a publisher. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, one person your agent hasn't contacted is me and Suspense Publishing, so you better tell them to email me over the book and see what we got, because this is exactly what we do, and I love the concept of it. And I love the enthusiasm, so it's definitely something that I would want to take a look at as your second one, and, you know, and the first one, so you got to have them send it over to me.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I'll definitely do that. I'll do that right away. But as I said before, it's, you know, the reservations that they had were the subject matter. And a lot of publishers, a lot of traditional publishers had it. In fact, the publisher who did the first Mickey Tussle book and the Echoes book, St. Martin's Press, they had it for a while. And they looked at it, and they really liked the writing. They loved everything about it. They just had such reservation about the subject matter, which I find... in a way, kind of crazy.
Boo-hoo. They need to get over it.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And a few of the people had said the same thing to me, and I said, you know what, I don't buy it. I didn't believe that people would have such reservation about the topic that they would not read the book. And, in fact, more women than men love the book. So it's
right.
The exact opposite.
That's the thing. Yeah, I know. I never look at things that way, and I kind of get upset when other publishers kind of try to think that they can understand the psyche of readers, because I'm going to tell you right now, nobody knows what makes a reader tick. Nobody knows. It's just a crapshoot. No one knew that Harry Potter was going to be that big, or Twilight, or some of the others.
Yeah,
heck,
exactly.
Some of the books they thought were going to be big were nothing. I mean, I interviewed Anne Rice, you know, Interview with a Vampire. She said sat there for a year and a half and didn't sell nothing, and then all of a sudden there was a cult following. And then it started to become big. So they, you know, don't even let them tell you what they think, because they don't know
thing.
Nothing.
And as you say, John, this kind of stuff happens. You know, it's not, you know, maybe not the little twists and turns, but it happens.
You read it, you turn the TV, and I see another teacher sleeping with a student and wanting, they fall in love and blah, 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 blah. And then it's like every day, bullying, text messaging, all this stuff. It goes on all the time. And I think it's great that you're, like I said, I think it's great that you're in high school, you see it, you live it, and that you're able to bring it to life and talk about it in a great psychological thriller.
Yeah, now, of course, when it came out, there are people who were coming out to me saying, Frank, I'm not in that book, am I? Like, it's not, you know, that's not me, is it? I'm like, relax.
That's not me, is it? But, hey, you know what that is? That's a compliment.
Right,
because,
I guess.
Like I always
that's how I'll
say,
take it.
Like I always say, if you have a reader that sends you an email saying how much they hate a character and they couldn't stand them, you did your job. because you touched them in an emotional level that you're supposed to do. If the worst email you can ever get is when they write to you and they can't remember the name of a character, then you have to go back and say, why did they not remember this character? And change them and fix it for the next time. That's
You know, it's interesting you say that, because one of the last conversations I had, I forget which publisher it was. It wasn't St. Martin's. Maybe it was Random House or one of the other major publishers. The last email I got from the editor who was considering it was something along the lines of, if the reader doesn't really like the character and in fact hates the character, the whole story is going to flop. And I almost became enraged when I read it, because, and especially now, if you look at all the TV dramas that people love, with The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and all these other, I forget the other one, Boardwalk Empire, all these characters, people, they're flawed characters. They're not, these pillars of society. But people still watch. They want to see what happens. What's going to happen with this guy or this particular person?
Right. And you know what else they do? They root for the person and say, oh, my God, I can't wait till this person dies. Will you kill them? I can't stand them. Kill them off. But that means you're getting to them at an emotional level. And I think it's great. But, hey, you know what? We only got about a minute left. I love talking to you. It's been a fabulous conversation. But kind of tell everybody where they can get in contact with you. And things of that nature, if you're going to do any blogs, where you're at, and stuff like that.
Sure. The website is, again, franknappy.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. And, there's an email section on the website. I have an assistant. Her name is Sophie. You can get in contact with me through her or directly through the other avenues of social media. I have done blog tours in the past. I have nothing scheduled right now, but I've got a bunch of things coming up, I think, through the summer. And like I said, the new thriller, which is called Flirting with Disaster, is yet to be placed, but it's engendered a lot of interest so far from several people. So I have my fingers crossed that next year something will be happening with that more concrete.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, Frank, thank you again so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. When you're done, you're going to email your agent. You're going to tell them to send it over to editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we're going to look at it from that point of view and say, can't wait to see what you got coming up in the future, though. I appreciate it.
Hey, John, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. You have a good one, Frank.
Thanks a lot.
Again, so everybody, again, that is author Frank Nappy. The book is called Nobody Has to Know. I think it's an excellent read, a great psychological thriller with a fabulous plot that is definitely relevant to today. And, again, that this is why we bring authors on, for you to find new authors, great ones that are coming up, and we had three of them for you today, J.E. Fishman, Nancy Allen, and Frank Nappy now. So there's no excuse for you not to go out and buy books to go read and say, I don't have nothing to read, because summer's coming around the corner. Fill your Kindle, fill it up with different books, and go out there and start reading. So we want to thank you all. We'll be back tomorrow with Suspense Radio One-on-One. We're going to be talking. I'll be on 10 a.m., and then we'll see you again in 2 weeks for Suspense Radio. So check out the schedule, and until that time, everybody, we want to say goodbye, good night, good day, good afternoon. We'll see you soon.